By which I mean a Christian system which presents the whole counsel of God. Now, I say this because so much of what we have today, which goes as Christianity, is Christian to the extent that it presents Jesus Christ as Savior. You take the average TV evangelistic program. You take many radio programs. What do they do? They say, yes, Jesus Christ died to save you. Now, that's wonderfully true. But may I point out to you that even Paul says, this is the milk of the Word. If you're really born again, what then must be operative in your life? Christianity is not only preaching redemption and regeneration, but it's also preaching sanctification, growth in grace, nurture, shepherding, discipleship, whatever you want to call it. I'm happy that so many groups, they are practicing various forms of discipleship under different names. You see, to say to the man, come up front, and he comes up front, I believe in Jesus Christ, you're saved, and you give him the right hand of fellowship, and then you throw him to the wolves, so to speak. And you're really done with him. You don't teach him anymore. You leave him in that infantile state. Now, I give Billy Graham full credit. He is trying to overcome this. He's very much aware of this problem in evangelism. And he's done what he can, humanly speaking, to safeguard against this. But it's very difficult to do. Very difficult to do. You know, I've been preparing a series of lectures for Pensacola this summer. And I've gone to the Covenanters, I've gone to Knox, I've gone to all the great moments in Presbyterian history. I was reading Knox's view of education. And the thing which made the Reformation so profoundly effective was the fact that these men insisted upon a thorough reformation of schools. Knox insisted in every presbytery there should be a school. Every church, every kirk should have what they call a grammar school. And then he designated St. Andrews, Aberdeen, and Glasgow as the three great universities of the Presbyterian Church in Scotland, St. Andrews being the key university. In other words, they were going to have a trained youthhood, they were going to have a trained ministry. Calvin's Academy at Geneva, the University of Geneva, the University of Wittenberg under Luther and Melanchthon, Cambridge under Cranmer and Edward VI and Elizabeth down to the 17th century. Cambridge turned out X number of great Puritan preachers. It influenced the formation of Harvard. You know, today, we'll never recover our sacred trust as prophets, priests, and kings until we start with a truly Reformation theology. Now, I don't mean just the evangelical theology. I'll admit that saves people. I rejoice in that. I give them the right hand of fellowship. But we need a truly Reformed theology. The real focal point of a recovery is Calvinism. Now, you know who will agree with me? Our enemies. As I pointed out once before, whom do the unbelievers, the liberals, attack? They don't attack Lutheran theology, except in passing. They don't really thrust their barbs at Methodist theology. They don't even thrust their barbs at Roman Catholic theology, except a few things, maybe like Mariology or transubstantiation, some, you know, wild things. But basically, when they're trying to undermine the Christian church, they go for the heart. They go for Calvinism. And they're right. Humanly speaking, they know that if they can demolish Calvinism, the rest will topple in their own way, which is true. Many, many evangelicals, fundamentalists, who say, like Bob Jones, for instance, I hate Presbyterianism. Where do they get their intellectual encouragement, the extent to which they have it? Where did they get their defense of the gospel? They get it from men like Machen and Warfield when they'll let them be read. Van Til when they'll let him be read. They derive their sustenance from the men whom they despise and the system which they don't like. Now, I'm being specific. We to have a consistent biblical theism, a consistent Weltanschauung, a consistent Christian philosophy, a consistent apologetic, what we need is a consistent theology.
Okay.
Some of you may think I am being dogmatic. I admit it. Because you've asked me to be specific. And we need that kind of a consistent theology to give birth to a consistent Weltanschauung based upon the whole counsel of God. The whole counsel of God does not just include the doctrine of redemption. It does include that, and you can't do anything until you have that. But having that, you must grow in grace. We must have self-conscious Christians. Now, then what do we do? Then we begin with education. Education has been the means by which America has been destroyed. No argument? Therefore, if we reconstruct or if we return to the Reformation theology and derive therefrom a biblical Weltanschauung, a world mind view, then we must then attack the problem of education. Now, you will say I'm being idealistic. I'm telling you what I would do if I could. I know I can't do it, so I'll make that very clear. If, yes, Dick. If,
are we doing this through the Christian education system?
Yes. Well, let me point this out first. If I had the power, I would destroy and bring to an end every public school system in the country this May or June. Because I am convinced that what is coming out of the public schools and what they're putting in the students is far more dangerous than ignorance. Now, I'm very serious about this. I think the school has become the nursery of destruction. It's a truism, say, that the centers of the drug trade, which is true. There are the centers of disrespect for parents. The center of the propagation of immorality, of the disrespect of the church, the turning away from the gospel, the turning away from the American heritage, the turning away from American culture. Now, what we must do then is to develop a Christian Weltanschauung in regard to education. Certainly in our Christian schools, and hopefully in all of education. Now, let's hold some of the questions which might come to your mind, because I can see them developing and I can understand why they develop. Remember, I've only begun this prescription. I haven't finished it. What are we going to do? I know of Christian schools, Christian name, which really teach humanism with a Christian veneer. They use the same textbooks. The teachers are trained in the same humanistic schools of education, and in essence they copy the public schools, and they claim to be Christians because they open prayer, they have Bible reading, they have Christian teachers. Now that's all fine, but it's only the beginning. If you teach humanism in your Christian schools, what do? You turn out better humanists than the public schools do. Granted, we need cultured people, but above and beyond that, we need schools which are consistently Christian in their goals and their purposes. Do you send your children to school so that they shall be socially adapted? Do you send them so you can get rid of them for 5 or 6 hours a day? Do you send them so that you can, so they can be trained to get a good job? Well, my parents will admit to this. I remember some years ago when they had that big school strike in New York City. The New York Times came out with I couldn't believe they'd write the editorial because it was so self-condemning. But they came out and pleaded for the teachers to go back to school because the schools were performing a social service by being child centers for the day. In other words, the real reason for public schools was that they children would be off the parents' hands. And they pleaded for the teacher to go back to relieve this problem. But not a word being mentioned of the problem of educating the children. I asked you what the purpose of all this was. What are you going to teach the students? Now, it's good to teach them 2 times 2 is 4. They ought to know their multiplication tables. To learn how to speak good English. It's necessary for them to learn these things. I'm all for it. I have no use for these uncultured Christian programs which make hash out of ordinary language, use terrible music, and so on. Our students ought to be brought into contact with good music in the second and third and fourth grades, adapted to their levels, with good literature, adapted to their levels. They ought to know that 2 times 2 is equal 4 because God has so ordained that 2 times 2 equals 4, that 10 times 10 is 100. They ought to know that the multiplication and our whole arithmetical system is based upon the arithmetic which God has printed into his universe, into his world. It's not just by hit or miss that 10 times 10 is 100, and you can't change it in that new math they've introduced by trying to change the mathematical setup. They can't do it. It has failed. It stopped it. You should teach the students at a very early age that mathematics reflects the mathematical relationships of a harmonious universe because God created it. And in all these courses, the fact of God's creation should be made manifest. Even at an early age, they should be taught languages. And they should be made aware of the fact that languages are God's means for our expressing our thoughts and for adoring and appraising him. Not just to teach English grammar, especially, but why is there such a thing as grammar? I don't mean to go into deep depths of linguistics for too early an age, but you see, I'm going to say, and you can jump all over me if you care to. The consistent misuse of grammar is the product of a careless thinking generation who sees no value in language. But you see, when you examine all the great languages, they all have rules of grammar. Those rules of grammar were not drawn up by some group saying there's going to be a period just for the sake of having rules of grammar. No. These rules of grammar are inherent and inbred in our natures. God caused Adam to speak. God gave language at the time of the destruction of the Tower of Babel. And languages obey certain laws because we as human beings reflect God's image. Now you see, did you ever get that in a course in language in school? No, you didn't, because that's the so-called mixture of church and state. But you see, you can't really teach appreciation of language until you put that in that. You can't really teach a proper understanding of mathematics and the value and the necessity of mathematics until you show that it's organically linked to creation, as the use of language is organically linked to creation, as color. I mean, why do certain colors harmonize more than others? Well, it's not because some group of artists got together and said they did. Artists recognize that this is inherent. And yet there's a color scale. And colors reflect the colors which God has placed in nature. The rainbow gloriously reflecting the basic colors. I don't have maybe had courses in art in school or art theory, but how many courses in art theory ever present such a concept? Now, I am trying to show you what education is all about. Now, you say, but the public schools don't teach that. Of course they don't. But you see, because even the remnants of that they once did teach has been banned by civil authorities and by the courts, so that now public education is totally bereft of any concept of goals, any concept of content of curriculum. And the curriculum is devised by popular consent. If they want a course in how to knit, they put it in. If they want a course in basket weaving, they put it in. And the great heritage of the West goes by the way, totally neglected. And the students come out, they don't know their mathematics, they cannot spell, they cannot use good grammar, they can't do all these things, and they don't even know why they should. One of the great values of studying Greek, and I guess Hebrew, I would think so, is to understand linguistics and the nature of the laws of language. It's certainly obvious in Greek. Now, you see, what's the real goal of education? The real goal of education is to instruct children in terms of the covenant to be good prophets, kings, and priests.
Did you say that again?
Yeah, the goal of true education must be to train young people, children, young people, to fulfill their function in the covenant of God as his prophets, priests, and kings. Now, if you really, as a teacher, believe this, then you will construct your curriculum accordingly. If you really believe this, you will not only construct your curriculum accordingly, but you will decide upon the way you will teach these courses and who will teach these courses. And you'll also decide upon the basic type of discipline to be used in that school. Now, what we're speaking of is the recovery or the reformation of education. Marvin, do you have a question? Now, students, you cannot do this on the basis of a fundamental theology. You cannot do it on the basis of the Roman Catholic theology. You can accept their goals and do it, and they've done a good job. I said a fundamental theology. I didn't say evangelical theology.
What do you mean by fundamental?
I mean a dispensational theology.
Covenant theology is not fundamental?
No, it's not. It's covenant. And now, it bears many of the marks of fundamental. Yes, it accepts the doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of God.
Fundamental to Scripture.
Yes, but not fundamentalism.
Which you relate to rent dispensation.
Yes, You can't do it in Arminian theology. You can't do it in Lutheranism.
It's an awful broad basis for a lot of Christians too.
I didn't say it enough. Now, I don't mean to imply that those schools will not do a better job than public school.
Better enough.
Well, I wouldn't put it that meekly. I think if they insist upon good scholarship with well-trained teachers, that they will do a great deal. But I'm talking about a complete transformation of the educational system. To have it truly biblical. Note, my aim here, what I'm saying to you, is not just to have an educational system which will save the nation. Now, don't misunderstand me, that's very important. But above and beyond that, I want an educational system which is honoring to the covenant-making God by his covenant-keeping people. In other words, there's a goal even better than saving the nation, and that is to have, because we're priests and kings, prophets, priests and kings, unto our children, unto the living Lord, there's such a thing as having a school which reflects that because God commanded it.
I got to ask a question at this point. How do you see the nation developing as the Christian schools go about this path, and the public schools go further into the human nature.
Well, I see your point. I'm going to try and answer. I would say this, that there's going to be tremendous antagonism. Already in North Carolina, in the county next to us, in Idle County, next to Rowan County, there's quite enough people going on because the school board wants more money and the enrollment's going down. And the school board's not going to put out more money for fewer students. Now, this is going to hurt. Now, one of the reasons there are fewer students is that in our part of North Carolina, there are a great many Christian schools. I've mentioned one school in Salisbury, which has over 300 students. There's another school which has about 200 students. There's another school which has, I don't know, maybe 150 students. And within, oh, say, 4 or 5 miles of Salisbury, there are 4 or 5 Christian schools of which probably have close to 1,000 students. Now, that may not sound much like to you, but in a school system where there are not so many students, to lose 1,000 students spells financial disaster. And I'm only speaking of our locality in North Carolina. There are Christian schools all over North Carolina. And it's an amazing number of Christian schools.
Why do they need more money for fewer students and getting?
Because they want more power and they want more gadgets. They want to spend money, and they don't like the idea of losing it. And this will increase the antagonism. On the other hand, there's another side of the problem, which is good. These Christian schools, for the most part, admit people who are students, or parents, are not Christian. Now, why do they send them there? For one very good reason. Because they happen to believe in good education. There's a Catholic school in town, which has about 300 students, 400 students maybe. Now, some of my good Presbyterian friends have sent their children there. I said to one, why do you do this? He said, do you know anything about the public schools? I said, yes. He said, that's why. Now, of course, this Catholic school has a very, very able Mother John, who's the headmaster. And she is a gem. She is a good teacher. And if any student came in there with dope, he wouldn't stay any longer than 10 minutes after she found it out. And she wouldn't say, go home. She'd arrange for rapid transportation. And she runs a good ship. She runs a tight ship. And she has Protestant teachers. Not all. She has two or three nuns and 4 or 5 Protestants. And she picks only the good ones. So that, they don't make them go to Catholic Mass, so that the Roman influence is diminished and the excellent education is enhanced. They have a Czechoslovakian priest who escaped with his life, more or less, out of communist Czechoslovakia. And he's not exactly friendly to communism. His English is grammatically good. He's very precise, very careful. But his pronunciation has some problems attached to it. But he's a good man in his way. And now, I'm not necessarily condoning that, but what I'm pointing out is this, that parents are getting thoroughly aroused, and rightly, with the low-quality public education. So that these schools, once they get them, particularly in the schools which I know, where, I don't mean to say they indoctrinate, but where they teach Bible, and where they instill Christian principles, and where they demand Christian behavior, they're having an impact. They're having an impact upon the town. Now, I see this continue, but you see, it has to be quality education. You just cannot have a school with its Christian name and which has the low standards of public schools. You can't do it. They will have no effect. But if you have a good theology, a good philosophy of education, with well-stated goals, teachers who know what they're doing, and they turn out good products, you can more than hold your own. Now, we've got to go into the college realm. Frankly, today, most college education is a fraud. I didn't say all. I said most. There are very, very few schools who really achieve or even try to achieve what they have in those first few pages in the catalog. And most of them couldn't achieve them if they wanted to. But they are they're the plug for the unwary parents. And you go and you have student parent day and you take your children to see the campus and some of the finest students they have, take them around and show them the library and show them the chapel, which is never used, and introduce them to two or three of the best professors, and they have some very carefully picked rooms where they will show them, and they'll show them the high spots and then whisk them out before anything happens. So the parents come away tremendously impressed with this school. And it's a rotten undercovering for the whole beautiful shell. This is true of the state schools. They're not delivering to the public what they say. They're taking public money under false pretenses. Private colleges are taking the tuition and the boarding room funds under false pretenses. You say, I'm a very bitter critic. No, I just know what I'm talking about. I've been on accrediting commissions. I've been to schools. I've seen colleges in operation. I've seen high schools in operation. I know what goes on. And I know that it is eating the heart of the nation from under it. Now, I see that we can do it, but we've got to have a consistent biblical theology. We've got to have a consistent biblical Weltanschauung, a consistent biblical concept of education. Now, this is very important, because the public school day is destroying the nation. The public and private colleges are destroying the nation. The universities are destroying the nation. Oh, I know they make great discoveries in science. But many of the professors that do that never or hardly ever teach a class. And they're paid high salaries for wandering around and making these discoveries. Millions of dollars is poured from the federal government treasury into these schools where the teaching is very bad. Professors don't go to class. They regard as a bore, and in view of some of the students that get there, I can see that it is a bore. I will concede the point. But there's no motivation. The average college professor today has no real goal except to earn his salary and survive until June. As the public school teaches, a girl came to me last week, a fine girl who graduated from Catawba, a fine Christian girl. She was engaged to one of my students. He's at Oxford. And she got a job teaching in the Idaho County School. And she came to me a week ago last Sunday. What's the date today? No, last Sunday she came. And I could see she was upset. And I said, Kim, what do you want? And she said, I have had it with the school. She'd struggled all year with it. And she said, I'm leaving at the end of this year. I said, can you go back? She said, that's not the issue. She said, yes, she could, but she can't. She said, I couldn't take it. I had another student come to me this year. They've had a full up to education. They can't take it. And they want to go into other work. So that the schools are not produced, they're not doing what they're claiming to do. They're jungles. But if we have good Christian schools, as I have outlined, with rigorous discipline, both in terms of behavior and in terms of what we require, we can reconstruct education. Our schools can become models. Now, if we do that, and if we go and establish sound Christian colleges and utilize those which do exist, like Covenant, for instance, Belhaven has come back into being a strong Christian college.
Was that up around Charlotte?
Not unless it moved recently. It has been Jackson, Mississippi, my friend.
Something up in Charlotte, Belmont.
Belmont, that's a Roman Catholic school. it has to be a good school. Cedarville College in Ohio is doing what I would want it to do. And there are other schools, I just happen to think a few offhand. They do exist. I think Bryan College is doing a good job. Not as good as Covenant, but I think it's certainly a reputable school, in my opinion. Incidentally, Ted Mercer, the president there, is a former member of the Bob Jones faculty, who's far outgrown Bob Jones, I might add. I have a great regard for him, I might add. Well, we go on like that. You see what will happen? There are any number of parents who are getting sick and tired of paying $4,000 and $5,000 a year to have their young people destroyed, to have them come home as addicts. Their girls are sex maniacs. They're just tired of it. I don't blame them. Now, what else can happen? There was a time when our Christian schools poured out a steady stream of political leadership. Madison College of New Jersey, Princeton. When Harvard was in its evangelical heights, it turned out John Adams, not to mention others. Most of New England leadership. You know, there was a time when the College of Charleston and the College of South Carolina, yes, they were state schools, but as late as 1850, Thornwell was president of the University of South Carolina, and I had his chapel addresses. He gave a series of chapel addresses on What is Truth. Unbelievable. Great. He gave Christian messages in the chapel at the University of South Carolina in Columbia. The University of North Carolina, when it was founded, people used to jib and say, yes, it's paid for by the state, but it's run by the Presbyterians. And a Presbyterian minister from near us, Dr. McCorkle, was the first president. And he was a Presbyterian. Samuel Davies had tremendous influence. Hampton Sidney, little old Hampton Sidney in Virginia, turned many men out. Great scholars in church and state. Never a big school. There was a time down below 1930-35 when Davidson College in North Carolina, before it became liberal, turned out I wouldn't know how many very able men. As a matter of fact, I saw an alumni count in which it supplied at one time 75% of the ministers of Presbyterian Church U.S. It turned out senators, governors. It turned out D.H. Hill.
That's the thing why they're changing. I don't understand how the mob today in democracy is going to honor any type of political scholarship. Citing Westmoreland as an example.
Okay, now here's to you. If you study mobs, no mob as a mob ever does what you think it does. A mob is always under leadership. And the problem is to turn for leaders to gain a willing following among the mob. Now, this is where Toynbee's correct. You see, people say, it's a Democratic majority. Well, don't kid yourself. Now, people, they think they do. People thought they elected Carter. But that was a carefully planned and skilled move. Where do you think Bush is coming from today? It's a carefully planned, skillful move. You see, Kennedy, whether you like him or not, manipulates the mob. The point is to turn out leadership. You know, there was a time, in the period from 1853 when he died, between 1820 and 1853, America had a group of leaders unsurpassed in the history of this country. The three most famous of whom were, of course, Webster, Clay, and Calhoun. Now, how do you think they kept office? How do you think they constantly were elected to one office or the other? Calhoun, the Senate Vice President, It wasn't because Calhoun spoke the language of the common man. He didn't. Why did he? How could he do it? He had the unique ability of capturing the loyalty of the people of South Carolina. They trusted him, and rightly. He had a great statesmanship ability. Henry Clay in Kentucky, unlike Calhoun, but he had a tremendous ability to capture the people and lead them where he thought they ought to go. Webster. Now, Webster was an orator, but when we think of Webster as an orator, we miss the point of Webster's real ability. He was an excellent lawyer, and he argued some of the most famous cases ever to come before the Supreme Court. He was an excellent lawyer. He was an excellent Secretary of State. He was an excellent senator. He was Mr. Excellent. Clay was Secretary of State. He was senator. He was Speaker of the House. You name it. Calhoun was Secretary of War, Secretary of State, Vice President, Member of the House, and ultimately United States Senator, one of the great forces in the Senate. Now, these men and others were able to capture the willing allegiance of the masses. Do you think everybody who heard Calvin understood Calvin? No. Calvin preached at St. Peter's. He preached 5-6 times a week. And he secured the allegiance of the people. Do you think everybody understood Martin Luther when he got up and said, "Ich hier stehe, so help me God, I can't do otherwise"? That phrase captured them. That phrase has roared down, echoed through history. But you see, he had that ability. What we need to do is to turn out leaders who are of unimpeachable character, who have ability, and who have the ability to transmit their leadership into an allegiance from the people. This has been done in this country. It's been done again and again and again, particularly in the early years. Now, it's more difficult today because you have TV to combat.
Well,
the news media, too. You got the news media, who falsify the news, omit the news, in other words, torture what they do print. But you see, pardon me, but let me give you an example. 1954, Strom Thurmond left the Democratic Party and ran as a Republican in an unprecedented move. You know what? Only time in American history a man was able to do what he did. He first ran as an independent, then became a Republican. He was elected. It was a very brave thing. Why had he been able to do it? Because in his career as senator from South Carolina, as governor of the state, he had won the confidence of the people, whether they agreed with him or not. They knew that he was an honest man. They knew that he was above reproach. And they accepted him. How do you think Jesse Helms got North Carolina? After his first election, I helped run that thing. He couldn't believe he'd won. And one day he was giving a talk in Salisbury, and he looked at me and said, "Well, I never knew how I did." I said, "Jesse, you remember the time I told you you were going to win?" He looked at me and said, "Yes." At the time, he didn't really believe me. Well, the reason for it is this, that even people who do not agree with Jesse Helms know he's a man of integrity. And if he's the only man to vote for something in Florida, he'll vote against it if he's against it. And he has captured, he gets in the office because so many Democrats love him and trust him. How did Walter George get elected so many times in Georgia? Because the people loved him, trusted him. Dick Russell. Let's forget it. You can get a bad leader, but if the Christian church, I mean the Orthodox church, will put forward leaders. See, we have neglected this, gentlemen, lady. We have said, we'll have nothing to do with politics, and we will send our children to public school. We will bury leadership. All we want them to do is to be saved, not go to the movies. And not smoke. And not go with like you who do. Now, I don't smoke. But that has been my preference plus the fact I played football, and the coach told me if I smoked, he ran a pack down my throat and watched me choke to death. And he was the kind who would have done that and done it with great glee, because he was the kind, he'd walk them, when in practice, he'd walk them down behind the line of scrimmage. I played guard, and he would kick you with such force, he'd send you sprawling in your nose in the mud. He kicked me with force, and he told me to get down in my appropriate appendages, and I didn't get down far enough to suit him. He kicked me down. I didn't like it. But I tell you, I knew one thing. I was going to be tough. I was going to be a good football player if he had the care of me to do it. And I respected him, although I was deathly afraid of him. Now, you see my point? We've got to have good leadership. We've got to stop namby-pamby. We've got to have discipline in the school and in the home. Now, the education is part of the recovery. It's a very vital part. I'm not opposed to education. I said I'm opposed to public education that today I would bring all the public schools to halt. That does not mean I'm opposed to education. If I were opposed, I wouldn't be here. What do you think I'm trying to do? I'm trying to train you. Now, you know, frankly, I have a great deal of sympathy for y'all. I know that you work. I know you have problems that way. I know that you have families. I'm aware of that, with one or two exceptions. But I would like, my dream is to make this school the outstanding Christian seminary in the country for scholarship, integrity, discipline, devotion, Christian character, and whatnot. And one way we can do it is to have discipline, that's not the right word, but high demands of scholarship. Now, I haven't done it because I was feeling my way, and I was like, I know you're a problem, but you're smart. You students are good, and I'm not doing you justice. I'll admit it. I'm not calling out of you that which you have in you. I'm not helping you to use the talents you have. You have training of various kinds, from aeronautics to engineering to counseling to electrical work. I don't know what you're what? Insurance man, aren't you?
No, I'm General Motors.
That's right, you're General Motors. And this girl has, I forget how many PhDs. I should call Dr. Myers. So, I confess. Now, let's go from there to the state. Obviously, when this country began, we had, to varying degrees, a well-defined political philosophy. The early settlers came up with a well-defined educational philosophy. The Huguenots, the Presbyterians, and the Anglicans had a good educational philosophy. Other groups, the Moravians had a high concept of education. The German Lutherans tried. They were not as successful, but they did try. But on the whole, all these Christian groups held the necessity of, although they didn't call it that, of a kind of covenantal educational outlook. Now, in regard to political philosophy, the Huguenots, the Scotch-Irish, and the English and the Puritans, who also held a high educational philosophy, they had a very high political thought. They had a highly developed political thought derived from the scriptures. The Puritans had a very high thought. The Scotch-Irish Presbyterians were well advanced. The Scotch were. The Huguenots were. As to government. Now, to be perfectly fair, and it is a remarkable thing, if you examine the original charters given to the London Company of 1606, the Plymouth Company of the same year, and the restructured Virginia Company of 1609, and again with the new charter of 1612, you come to a remarkable thing that in the charter of that company, you find a biblical philosophy of government. Amazing. A lot of people don't. I didn't realize it took graduate courses in in constitutional history, and really had to read for the professor the text of these charters. I should say my professor of constitutional history was Herman Vandenberg Ames III. He was president of the Mayflower Society of the United States of America. He was a Puritan of Puritans. He could have walked into Massachusetts town meeting in 1630 and been perfectly at home, and they would have accepted him. He was an old-time Calvinist of the Puritan stock, a thorough gentleman, a tremendous scholar, and he had us read the texts because he wanted to see the theistic foundation for the colonial government. Now, when you come to South Carolina and the Huguenots and the Scotch-Irish who settled upper South Carolina, the Scotch-Irish who settled North Carolina, and the Scotch around, eastern part of the state around Fayetteville down that way, Lumberton in that area, and the Huguenots who came in on the coast along with the Swiss at Newbern. When you come to Virginia, to the Huguenots and to the Anglicans, you have that same view of government. And the Presbyterians in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, you had that same concept. The German Reformed, the Congregational Puritans of New England, the Dutch Reformed in New York, they all had a strikingly similar philosophy of government. They all subscribe to the idea that government has its origins in God. All government is ordained of God. They believe that all government derives its rightful powers not from the people, but from God. That is ordained of God to achieve basic purposes. What are those purposes? What are they? The preservation of domestic order, to preserve to ensure justice, and to preserve against foreign attack. That's all government has to do. Now, you see what has happened. We have loaded government with more and more and more and more power. I'll tell you frankly what needs to be done. Now, you say, oh, I'm a hopeless idealist. I grant you probably won't be. But I'm telling you now what ought to be done, not what I think will be done. Make that point clear. I think that the vast majority of laws passed since 1933 ought to be repealed. I would repeal all but two or three amendments to the Constitution. The 25th I would leave. The 20th, which prescribes the method of electing the president, holding him to two terms, and possibly one other. I will repeal all the other amendments except for the Bill of Rights and 11 and 12. And you say, reactionary? Sure. But let me point out something to you. As Herman Vandenberg the Ames so forcefully put it, the downfall of the Constitution began when we began to amend it, beginning with the 13th Amendment, the 14th, the 15th, the 16th, the 17th. Which the 17th is the direct election of 8 United States senators. The 16th is income tax. I would abolish them. The 18th is already gone. I would abolish the 19th. I would abolish the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th. Because I'm chauvinistic now. Not at all. Those amendments have given power to the federal government, which the federal government are. Let me rephrase. No government has a right to exercise, but particularly the federal government, because they have all added to the centralizing power of the federal government, and they have, by that very nature, contracted the legitimate liberties of the people.
Who governs?
Least.
Which amendment is women's suffrage? 16th?
19th. Now, I didn't say women shouldn't vote. I said I repeal the 19th Amendment. Now, you see the difference? Now, the reason for it is this, that the federal government, by the 19th Amendment, was given the power to override the laws of states. You see, let me point out something to you. Legitimate government, historically and biblically, is in the states. because the states apply common law. The biblical injunction to government does not mean the federal government. It means the states. When you come to Romans 13, you're talking about the powers which are inherently and legitimately in the states. Now, I point something else to you.
Why can't you apply it to the
federal? You can apply it, but it has usurped power over the states. But I mean, the 13th of Romans is talking about the powers that apply what we call common law in English jurisprudence. Now, may I point out something to you? I did my dissertation in Confederation history, that is, the history of the Articles of Confederation from 81 to 89. And my book is still in print if you want to buy it. It's been the standard work in this since 1940. It's still in print, still being sold by the Porcupine Press in Philadelphia. I originally had it with the University of Pennsylvania Press. And when they were cleaning house and getting rid of things, they'd had it long enough, and they weren't really pushing it. I let them, the University of Michigan Press, have it. And then they went great guns for a while. Then the demand slackened. And then the Porcupine Press asked for permission to reprint in a hard cover. And I granted it to them about 3 years ago, and it's selling well. I'm not bragging, but I mean, what I mean to say is, I did a great deal of work in American constitutional history, and I am absolutely convinced, beyond any doubt, that the states were sovereign.
What's the name of the
book? South Carolina and the Confederation, 1781 to 89. It was my first literary effort. Now let me point out something to you, students, in support of what I'm trying to tell you. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. But what the states were intended to be sovereign and are still sovereign, and that secession is perfectly justified. Have I shocked you?
Mm-hmm.
There is no argument you can possibly bring against the right of secession except the fact that 24 million people can defeat 9 million people, which is nothing more than democracy wrecked. My loyalty, my supreme loyalty, is the state of North Carolina. The states are sovereign. They apply the common law. If you look at Romans 13, the type of law which is being discussed and described in there is a law which is enforced by the states. Now, as the states have surrendered their law, the power to enforce law, to the federal government, they have lost their liberties, and so have we. One thing which made me boil, was the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. Now, why? The answer is very simple. The federal government threatened any state which did not enforce it with the loss of its highway funds. Now, that, was, of course, was bribery. Secondly, a 55-mile-an-hour speed may be very wide, but it is part of the common law for the protection of life and property, which is a function of state government. Thus, the federal government had no right to enforce that. If Carolina, North Carolina wants to enforce it as part of its state law, that's all right with me. But I resent the fact that it was coerced in doing so by the federal government on the threat it would lose its highway funds. To begin with, since Carter has now reduced highway traffic considerably, there's no need for the highway funds as it once was. I stopped the day to get the gas at my service station, and the owner came. I just got talking to him when I was driving down the street. I said, "How's your gas situation?" He said, "You really want to know?" He says, "We're only selling 80% of what we sold last year." I deal with two stations. I thought, said, "Well, he lowered his gas price 2 cents a gallon." I said, "Why'd you do that?" He said, "I had to do something to get the ball rolling. They're really having trouble selling gas. They're coming from Charlotte, from Salisbury, Charlotte. I didn't count the cars. I couldn't. But I noticed that there was nothing like the traffic there was 6 months ago, or nothing like a year ago. Nothing. And this is summer season where people ought to be traveling. They didn't even travel that much at Easter time. Gas is way off. Now, I saw in the paper this morning that there is a glut of gasoline, so much so that the refineries are going to have to stop refining gas because they've exhausted the storage tanks. Which means what? That they're not selling it. Now, I didn't mean to get off on that, except to point out we've got our whole thinking reversed. So what do we have to do? We have laws about everything. what you name it. Not just busing of school buses. That's ridiculous. That's bad. But wife and husband relationships. The government's trying to take more and more control over so-called abused children. If you spank your child, it's abuse. Frankly, children need Christian abuse. Applying the proper geographical areas of their anatomy. I was spanked. I felt abused. Oh, I didn't like it. I mean, I was humiliated, but didn't. I don't think it hurt my personality permanently. It never will. If you do it in love, and you know that they know their love. Everything today is subject to federal regulation.
After removing the amendments, would you remove the commission?
What commission?
All the commissions that are laws unto themselves.
Yes, I would. Beginning with the Federal Trade Commission, which has been had its wings clipped, I would do away with the Interstate Commerce Commission. Allegedly, it was supposed to regulate interstate commerce to reduce to enhance competition. Today, now I happen to know this for a fact. Two freight cars up in the Spencer Yards jumped the track and hit another freight car. Nobody was hurt. The cars were messed up a bit. The ICC sent down four people to investigate the accident. Three or four freight cars. And they all had peculiar reports. Let me give you, and our librarian said this to me in the college. It was ridiculous. Some years ago, the ICC put out a report, quote, on the best way to ship watermelons from Seattle to Chicago. Laugh if you would. But she showed me the document put out by the ICC, and incidentally supported by the Agriculture Department, that the best way to ship watermelons is to place them lengthwise in the car, but they're less likely to roll if the train stops suddenly, which I think a dose of common sense would have made rather clear. Now, this was a federal expenditure by the ICC. The ICC has overregulated the railroads, and now they're trying to deregulate, and they've overregulated trucks. You know, you take a truck. Well, we have McLean in Winston-Salem, and we have Pilot in Winston-Salem. Now, they can take a load of goods, let's say Camel cigarettes. They can take that load of goods from Winston-Salem to Atlanta. They can't come back with a load of goods.